AP Radio News. I'm Tim McGuire. An Illinois man who has had business dealings with an Indiana man diagnosed with MERS has tested positive for the antibodies linked to the disease. The CDC's lead investigator on the case, Dr. David Swerdlow.
This business associate, who is an Illinois resident, has been identified as having evidence of apparent past infection with MERS-CoV.
The Illinois man never needed medical care, showing only the symptoms of a mild cold. The CDC says other people who were in contact with the first patient, including family and co-workers, have so far shown no symptoms of MERS. Colorado's governor signs the Right to Try law, a way for terminally ill people to use experimental drugs not yet approved by the Food and Drug Administration. AP Shirley Smith tells us more.
The legislation clears the way for drug companies to provide experimental medications to patients outside of clinical trials. Drug makers would not be required to do this, however, and some critics say the legislation really won't lead to greater access.
The North Korean government issues a rare apology for the collapse of an apartment building being built in Pyongyang. AP's Raphael Wober reports from Seoul that a South Korean government official fears that a large number of people, possibly even new tenants of the building, may have been killed.
The North Korean official position is that the new residents of that building had not yet fully moved in. The understanding here on the ground is that new residents of apartment buildings will go in to finish off their apartments, decorating or putting in fittings before they're fully ready to live in, but that people weren't actually living there yet.
The Turkish government has detained 18 people, including the top managers of a coal mine where 301 miners died last week. News agencies report prosecutors were questioning at least five people today. This is AP Radio News. The Balkans. At least 25 people are dead. The head of Bosnia's tri-presidency says once the water goes down, they have to find a way to help thousands who have lost their homes.
They will have to take care of 100,000 of people.
Landslides have buried roads, homes, and entire towns in Bosnia. 29th annual AIDS walk today in New York.
About 35,000 people are expected to walk the 6.5 miles in and around Central Park, says Kirshna Stone, a spokeswoman for Gay Men's Health Crisis, which is one of the organizations that benefits from funds raised by the AIDS walk.
One of the most important reasons why we must keep walking and we must keep raising funds is that the epidemic is not over. About 132,000 New Yorkers live with this disease.
And Stone says each year about 50,000 people become infected across the country. Julie Walker, New York.
I'm Tim McGuire, AP Radio News.
This is Mark Amtower. If you're looking for cost-effective and efficient methods for marketing your products or services to the government or to other government contractors, look to LinkedIn. There are over 400,000 members in the D.C. area and more than 92 million nationwide, but only a small percentage actually use it well. I can show you how to leverage LinkedIn in ways that support your marketing, sales, and business development efforts. I do this for large and small companies, and I can do it for you. Drop me a line at mark@federaldirect.net.
In today's competitive job market, imagine not having the reading skills needed to even fill out an application. 90,000 adults in D.C. are considered functionally illiterate. It takes a lot for an adult to admit they can't read. It takes even more courage to do something about it. The Washington Literacy Center teaches adult learners to read, giving them options and a bright future. Please give back to the community by donating today. Go to WashingtonLiteracyCenter.org and make your much-needed charitable contribution. Changing lives through literacy. WashingtonLiteracyCenter.org.
Hey, everybody. It's David and Nikki Nellis with Foodie and the Beast, the D.C. area's one and only food and wine variety show.
Next Sunday, May 18th, there's an invasion in the Foodie and the Beast studio. We've got New Zealand winemakers. They're in town, and they're going to be pouring.
That's Foodie and the Beast this coming Sunday and every Sunday right here on 1500 AM at 11.
GovEvents.com is your one-stop shop for government and military events worldwide. With hundreds of event organizers posting their government and military-related conferences, trade shows, expos, webcasts, and more, you'll save time and energy using GovEvents to find events to attend, exhibit, or sponsor. Search for government and military events by date, location, keyword, organizer, or focus. It's free, so join today. GovEvents.com. That's GovEvents.com.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired and entertained and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Tysons Corner, Virginia offices of Dixon Hughes Goodman. This is your host, Dana Theus from InPower Coaching, with my co-host, Colin Callahan of Colin Callahan & Associates. We have a great lineup of guests for you on our show today, including Ann Bassage, CEO of the Neurology Center, Jack London, Executive Chairman and Chairman of the Board of CACI International and author of Character, the Ultimate Success Factor, Stan Sulloway, President and CEO of Professional Services Council, and Sharon Wirtz, Founder and CEO of FCI Federal. We're starting off today with Ann Bassage, CEO of the Neurology Center. Ann, what is the Neurology Center?
The Neurology Center is a large medical practice with 9 offices in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area, 24 neurologists and neuropsychologists.
And you're relatively new there.
I am indeed, 7 months on the job.
Wow, and you're still excited and bubbling over. What do you love most about this job?
As my sons described, I'm Captain Kirk in the driver's seat, just moving the controls around. It's a very busy operation. Medicine today is very thin margins, and you have to manage every aspect of it.
So just for our listening audience, you are much more beautiful than Captain Kirk.
Thank you.
So you like to be in the driver's seat.
I do indeed.
Where did this instinct come up? Were you, as a child, always in the driver's seat, always in charge?
Absolutely not. I'm the middle child of 5 with 2 brothers on either side of me. Never got to play in the games, never got to speak at the dinner table. Wasn't necessarily discrimination. It was just they didn't think I had that much to say. Hmm. And I always wanted to be heard, so I worked hard to be heard.
When was the first time you felt heard?
Probably after my first big job.
Hmm.
When I got promoted from a mid-management position to a senior management position, it was kind of the outside affirmation that they needed, I needed to move forward stronger.
But the drive to be heard certainly started a lot younger.
Oh, absolutely.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in New Orleans and then North Carolina, Charlotte, mm-hmm. North Carolina.
Mm-hmm. And you ended up north.
Ended up north because North Carolina in the 70s offered women basically 2 opportunities, to be a teacher or to be in banking. And I really wasn't interested in either.
Hmm. What were you interested in?
I think I wasn't sure at the time. I was interested in exploring life and myself. I knew I couldn't stay in North Carolina, though, or I would get pigeonholed in one of those 2 professions and neither offered promise.
So what brought you up to the Washington area?
We used to come to Washington from college, mm-hmm. Chapel Hill, mm-hmm. and it just seemed like a sophisticated hub of business, of activity, of fun, and it drew me.
Mm-hmm. And what did you get as your first job when you got here?
I worked for Zarboff Parking Corporation. I wanted to go into advertising or marketing research, found out I could for $8,000 in 60 words a minute. Went to an agency and said, I don't care what it takes, but I need $13,000 a year. Uh-huh. Next day, I was employed.
Great.
Do you have a turning point in your life you'd like to share with us?
I think it was post-college travel to Europe.
Hmm.
I did the traditional backpack through Europe. And when I came home, I realized that I had managed myself, my resources, gotten into trouble, gotten out of trouble for 3 months, and I was capable. And with that, I packed up and moved up here in a Volkswagen and never turned back.
So was that a lesson you could have learned in the States, do you think?
Oh, for sure. For sure. I think you can do it. If you are willing to become independent, even if you live across the street from your parents' home, if you are willing to truly live by your wits and your skills.
So I wonder, going back to when you were the odd girl out as a child and between these boisterous brothers, were you really breeding your independence there? Is that where you learned to be independent?
Well, it was a desperation to want to be heard, and though my mother tried to, channel me into the prom queen mode, I was really more inclined towards the business mode. And so it was a constant seek of affirmation by the male contingent in the household, which, of course, was the dominant contingent.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What did your mom and dad do as you were growing up?
My mother was primarily a homemaker, did create and was successful interior designer, and my father was a mechanical engineer with Babcock & Wilcox. Mm-hmm.
And you said in the green room that he traveled quite a bit.
He did. He was a sales manager on the East Coast.
Mm-hmm. And so what was going on in the household with all those boys that you wanted to get involved in and couldn't?
Sports. Mm-hmm. And of course, growing up in the South pre-Title IX, I got channeled into tennis, which turned out quite well, actually. sports, business, things of intrigue and culture. You wanted to go there.
That's where your curiosity was.
Yes.
What was your first job?
My first job was probably babysitting, and then I taught tennis at summer camps and worked during high school years, always to make money to go do something, to travel some more.
Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, did those early jobs brew this interest in business, or was that something else? Was that
it brew an interest in having my own money.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
To control my destiny. Yeah.
Right,
yes.
Exactly. What did you do with your money back then?
Oh, in high school, I took a trip, a Young Life trip from North Carolina to California and back on buses.
What did you learn on that trip?
How to get along with a lot of different people, because it was a cross-section across Charlotte's high school arena, and it was just a variety of people.
Mm-hmm. So as a CEO today, what did you learn from your mother that shows up in your leadership style today?
Kindness, listening, not being afraid to make a decision.
Mm-hmm. Decisiveness. And how about for your dad? What leadership style from your dad shows up?
Honesty. Mm-hmm. Determination. Setting out to do a job and getting the job done.
Mm-hmm. So those are all things that you saw in him and they absorbed them.
Yes.
So you grew up in a home full of boys and then you had children.
Indeed.
That was,
and two boys.
Yeah, I was going to say, tell us about your boys. What did they learn from their leader mom?
It's funny. My son, my 22-year-old, who is set to graduate in June, announced 2 or 3 years ago he was going to forsake his pre-med pursuits because it didn't jive with his lacrosse team schedule. And I said, wait a minute, let's review why we are in college. And he threw right back at me my very own words, which was, Mom, it's about balance.
That's interesting. How did you react?
I sucked in a lot of hot air and said, okay.
So is it harder running an organization or running a family?
I think the biggest challenge and the biggest accomplishment is certainly having been a mother and a parent.
Mm-hmm. Did you learn anything being a parent that you found helpful to you in your leadership journey?
That human beings are fallible, that we make mistakes, and you have to learn from your mistakes. You get smarter from your mistakes, and you move forward accordingly. I think the best employee is an employee who recognizes they've made a mistake, comes forth, admits it, and then also offers a solution.
So are your brothers aware of your success today?
Yes,
indeed. And how about your dad?
Unfortunately, my father passed away about 18 years ago.
And so what do you, what would your brothers say about their sister now?
She done good.
And would they take some ownership in that?
Possibly. In spite of the the lifestyle growing up, but yes, no. We're a very tight family. I'll see all of them next week down at the beach, and we remain good friends and share advice and stories all the time.
So I'm wondering if there are other young women out there wondering how they can be heard and wanting to be heard. What advice would you give them?
Do your homework. Know, develop a base of knowledge that you can operate from. And then don't be afraid to deploy that knowledge. Always be prepared to absorb lessons from others, both good and bad, and model the good and remember the bad and not repeat it.
Mm-hmm. And what would you tell everybody about how to handle failure?
Learn from it, move forward, forgive yourself, and keep on going.
Keep going.
Mm-hmm. What does success mean to you today?
I have two healthy, great sons. I live independent. I think I serve my community, my family, and my business well. I'm proud of that. Mm-hmm. And I think I make a difference in the world.
Mm-hmm. What about mentors?
Mentors, there's never one single mentor. It goes back to what I said for the young girls, is look around you, take the best you can learn from it, and keep moving forward. I've had the opportunity to work for a lot of people, really smart men and women. One of my current mantras is always choose the hard right over the easy wrong, and I learned that from him.
Uh-huh. Excellent. What's the website?
www.neurologycenter.com.
This is Dana Theis with my co-host, Colin Callahan. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in just a moment, right after this Business Spotlight. Joining us for this Business Spotlight is Scott Bresler, partner at Dixon Hughes Goodman, Certified Public Accountants and Advisors. Scott, what is Dixon Hughes Goodman?
We are a regional CPA firm and consultants, and we advise middle market companies on finance, accounting, tax, those types of things.
Who's a perfect client for Dixon Hughes Goodman?
A perfect client for us is middle market companies. Typically, they're growing. We're very industry focused, so one of our core industries, government contracting, is one of my specialty areas. Banking, insurance, real estate, construction, nonprofit, some of those other core industries that we service.
So when they become clients, what do they love most about working with you?
I think they love most about working with us is we really see our clients as partners, and we really function as partners with them in you know, the strategic goals that you're trying to obtain. How do they get there from a finance, accounting, tax aspect, consulting? Like I said, our industries, we dive very deep into our industries and build our services really around those industries and just provide a lot of value added to them.
And what do you love working for Dixon Hughes Goodman?
It's a great organization. I do love working with the clients and the types of clients that we have. Very entrepreneurial clients. They're growing, working with them, seeing, you know, what's going to be the next challenge, what's the next hurdle, how can we help them get over that, you know, strategically working with them on vision. And, you know, it's, as I said, a kind of partnering with them, and, you know, it feels like you're helping them grow their business while we grow our business as well. So it just makes it kind of fulfilling from both sides, growing my business, Dixon Hughes Goodman, and helping them grow their business at the same time.
What's the website?
It is dhgllp.com.
Thank you for listening to this Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Dana Theis, with my co-host, Colin Callahan. Next up, we have Jack London, Executive Chairman and Chairman of the Board of CACI International and author of the book, Character, the Ultimate Success Factor. Jack, tell us about CACI. What is it?
CACI is a New York Stock Exchange public corporation, thousands of shareholders, headquartered out, licensed out of Delaware. And our business is primarily the United States government, and we're in the information technology, communications, and network services business. We have about $3.8 billion in sales, 16,000 employees around the world, and we've been doing all this, founded in 1962. So we've been growing steadily since that time.
And you've been with the company almost since the beginning, since it was a boutique company.
I have indeed. I joined the firm in 1972 as employee number 35. It had been as 10 years, and I was employee 35, so you can easily do the math.
So what was, over this growth that the company has gone through, what was your role in moving the company from a boutique to a major, major business?
I brought to the company, Dana, an experience and skill set and background in military logistics and computer systems applications. Mm-hmm. Remember what time frame you're talking about. It was early applications, sophisticated applications of computers in these fields. Mm-hmm. And I had a bridge that from my experience in the military service. I was in for a total of 24 years, 12 years active at that time when I left the service and went into CACI. So I brought a knowledge of the problem set and challenges and opportunities to apply automation to these fields of the logistics field primarily. So that's the breakthrough that I brought.
And you had a vision of what more
that we could do that in a more robust, significant way. And I saw, I believe the computer technology was going to become more sophisticated and complicated. The rapid change in technology was going to be something that would be very difficult for program managers and the government to keep up with. And industry was ideally suited to do that. And I felt like there was a real opportunity for us.
Well, one of the things that I found most engaging in talking to you just in preparation for this interview was how, even though you had this technical knowledge and this business knowledge and this vision, you came to appreciate early on that it was the people and the character of the people that made the difference for the business. Tell us a story as early as you can remember it about how important people are to making a business really successful.
Well, specifically at CACI, I had a project early on. It was a software development job for the Trident submarine program, and I got about halfway through it, and one of my lead programmers decided that he was going to leave. And when he left, and I began to find out that the project was a little bit more in trouble than I'd otherwise learned, I realized it was like an epiphany that I was going to have people of integrity that would come forward when they had issues, so we could make adjustments. And all projects have difficulties. But that was a big epiphany for me. I realized that I was going to have people that could communicate and would be forthcoming and a whole different type of individual, which we pursued ever since, by the way.
And I'm hearing in your discussion of it also, you realized you had to have an integrity that allowed them to feel safe coming forward to you.
Oh, absolutely. It is all it's a leadership role model situation. Lead by example. Mm-hmm. And the ability to let people know that it's all right to have problems, because we can fix them, but what we can't do is hide them.
So how young were you when you were first recognized for your leadership capability?
In my junior high school days, I received from the principal at a graduation ceremony an American Legion Citizenship Award. And I'd come from a family with a lot of military experience in Second World War and earlier, as a matter of fact. And I received the American Legion Award for Citizenship. And I wasn't really sure what the American Legion was all about or citizenship, so I kind of looked into it, and I realized how well it fit and how important it was. And it sort of gave me a feeling for what might be the potential in a leadership role.
And from that, how young were you as you realized the importance of character and where that started to show up?
I think I picked a lot of the notions of integrity, of being accountable, being responsible for my mother and father, uh-huh. Who were independent proprietors, small business people that had come pioneers across the country. And this was in Oklahoma, where uh-huh. I was raised. Uh-huh. They had their own little business. They didn't look for handouts from anybody. They were always accountable, no matter what the consequences, and took responsibility for themselves and for us and for my brother and I. Uh-huh. And I learned a lot in terms of taking care of myself, if you will.
Yeah. Did you help out?
Self-reliant.
In those, Did you help out in those businesses?
Yes, I did.
And how young were you when you got involved?
I'm 12 years old. I did all kinds of janitorial stuff for my dad's store. I was the sweeper on Saturday mornings, and then later I became a truck driver for the deliveries, and I was involved with his business quite a bit, as a matter of fact. I learned a lot of accountability issues from him, too.
Right.
Did you enjoy working with your father?
Immensely. I observed something that you don't see so much today, and that was with his vendors and suppliers, the handshake agreement. They'd follow up with a letter, but these gentlemen and these ladies in this particular small proprietary world, their word was their bond, and they had their reputation was well known in their community. So integrity and living up to what you committed to was a big deal,
right.
A really big deal, because it was so visible. I don't think you see that quite the way you do.
Right, there's a certain anonymity today.
Yeah. We're a different society.
Yeah.
I know a lot of leaders who, like you, talk about the importance of character and integrity. I don't know a lot of them that actually write a book. Why did you write the book?
I've seen, first of all, the notion of integrity and character and the ethos of our corporation and its culture is very important to the success of the company. And so I started out writing the book to be a document that I would put 3.5 years ago disseminate to our employees with the idea of reinforcing the integrity idea. But what I saw in society, and I started collecting anecdotes of all the difficulties and problems we have in our society and what's really, I think, a very negative trend line. Lots of problems, lots of things popping up every day, literally, that I thought I could do a nice book on it. And I have loaded with anecdotes and stories of integrity and people that have stood up for doing the right thing. One of my role models in here was Jonas Salk, who was the fellow that discovered the polio vaccine. Mm-hmm. Instead of taking the great fortune that would have been possible for him to take, he made that patent open to the society for the good of people. Mm-hmm. That, to me, was an expression, ultimate expression of the finest of character. So I have examples like that loaded through this book, and I have a lot of hints and ideas on leadership and how you can build your successful career. And so I'm very comfortable that there's a lot of good tips and juicy stuff in there for you.
So give us an example. You know, sometimes, particularly in a leadership role, when there's a lot at stake, and you have to make a decision that's hard, and the decision that has the most integrity might not be the best for your business in that moment. What advice do you give to people who are at that point in that really tough decision?
It's to refuse to consider the consequences for yourself. You have to, I read a book many years ago, Profiles in Courage, and I have it autographed by John Fitzgerald Kennedy. My mother got it for me. This was 1961 when he became president, and I've carried that little book around with me. The message in the book is doing the right thing regardless of the consequences for you as an individual. And if you can ever garner that as being the most important part of character, you're going to be okay. I have a couple of the endorsers of this book were former POWs in Vietnam. Edward Alvarez, 8.5 years incarcerated. Lee Ellis, 5.5 years incarcerated. They subscribed to the notion of character as being one of the main things that got them through their incarceration.
Did you meet them?
Oh, they're close friends of mine. Mm-hmm. Roger Staubach has endorsed my book. The former chairman, CEO of Lockheed Martin, Norman Augustine, wrote the foreword to my book. So there's people that really buy into what we're trying to promote here.
And you're giving their stories voice.
I am indeed, yes.
What, in your leadership style, what did you learn from your dad that shows up in that leadership style today?
Clearly accountability.
Uh-huh.
Clearly, you're responsible for yourself. And one of the themes in my book here, Colin, is that character is something, is a quality we can all own, mm-hmm. that no one can take from us. No one can take it from you. Mm-hmm. You own that no matter what. And I think I picked up that notion, at least from my father, the idea of accountability, responsibility, having somebody else have to take care of you.
Yeah.
So it's a big deal for me in my youth.
How about from your mom? Is there a specific thing from your mom that you learned that shows up in your leadership?
My mother had a sensitivity to people,
uh-huh.
and great respect for her peers and colleagues and friends, really, her social friends. Mm-hmm. And I sense the value of that in the bonding of relationships and being able to trust each other when death in the family, other hardships. We went through some pretty rough times. Mm-hmm. My mother and father were both endured the Great Depression and the Grapes of Wrath in Oklahoma from the dust storms and the dust bowls and all that business. And my mother almost perished with a rheumatic fever. So they've had some hard times. But I think in some ways those crucibles created the notion of their own integrity and character. Mm-hmm. I mean, going through hard times and being able to stand through them and get through them, I think builds character, if I can pony up that notion.
Yeah.
And if your mother and father were here today, what would you like to tell them?
How proud I am of them, yeah.
And you have a big family. What if your whole family were crowded around with us right now, your children and your grandchildren? What would you like to tell them?
Oh, man. That I want to be a model for them, and I want to live up to the best that I can so that I can be somebody they can be proud of and reflect on as they grow to the maturity.
What's the website?
We're at www.caci.com, and there also is a connection to characterthebook.com.
Thank you. This is Dana Theis with my co-host, Colin Callahan. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in just a moment after this business spotlight.
And your name is?
Dana Theis.
And the name of the organization?
EmpowerCoaching.com.
And what does Empower Coaching do?
Well, we support mid-level to senior managers mm-hmm. and leaders mm-hmm. Achieve professional success by developing themselves personally.
Why does this turn you on so much?
Well, I have found in my own experience and my own leadership journey mm-hmm. that the better I was at being a good human being, the better mm-hmm. leader and the better business I ran and mm-hmm. the more successful I was. And I want to help other people do that.
So you're able to help the folks in an organization throughout the organization achieve what they're looking for, as well as help the organization move forward.
Well, to move an organization forward, mm-hmm. you've got to master the soft skills of mm-hmm. dealing with people effectively. Mm-hmm. You've got to learn to negotiate every relationship successfully mm-hmm. for mm-hmm. both parties. Mm-hmm. You have to communicate confidently. Mm-hmm. I support people and help them learn to develop those skills themselves to be strong mm-hmm. leaders.
And you have a specialty working with women?
I do work a lot with women. Mm-hmm. They're drawn to this work, but not mm-hmm. exclusively.
Mm-hmm. And to learn more about what you're up to, is there a website address?
InPowerCoaching.com. That's InPowerCoaching.com.
Excellent. This has been your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Dana Theis, with my co-host, Callan Callahan. Next up, we have Stan Sulloway, President and CEO of the Professional Services Council. Stan, what is the Professional Services Council?
PSC is the primary national trade association for companies that provide services and technology to the federal government. So we're basically an advocacy organization. We're kind of the eyes, the ears, and the voice of the industry.
And how big or small is it?
We have just under 380 member companies, with staff of 18, about to grow by almost a third in terms of staff. So we've gone to be pretty big size as associations go.
Why did you take this job?
That's a great question, because when I was in the government at the time and I was being recruited to this job, and I actually didn't want to go to a trade association because I didn't think most of them were dynamic, kind of type A places to match my personality. But I was recruited by a CEO of a large company who was chairman of the board, and he and the board convinced me that they wanted me to take a whiteboard and kind of reinvent the place and do what I thought we had to do and kind of clear sailing ahead. And they've stuck by that for 13 years.
You didn't start in the government, though, either.
No.
You started out on your own.
I was a consultant, public affairs and public policy consultant. I worked for a firm for about 5 or 6 years, and then was on my own for another 20 after that.
So I'm really curious, when you were young, what was this interest in sort of politics that took you all the way from being an independent outside to being all the way inside? Where did that interest really
I grew up
develop?
In a very political house. My dad was in politics. It was one of many careers he had. Although it wasn't a career for him, it was an avocation. He worked all the time, but politics was very important to him. And whether it was the civil rights movement or other things, we just had a very politics-focused house, and it was one of the passions I kind of grew up with as a kid.
What was most interesting to you about it as a kid? There's a lot of kids that are just like, eh, whatever, I don't care. But you cared.
I don't know that I cared. I was a kid. I think I found I thought it was fun. When his partner ran for governor, his business partner and close friend ran for governor on Saturdays, I'd go with my dad down to campaign headquarters, and I'd just lick envelopes and type envelopes and do that kind of thing. And one day he grabbed me by the arm and said, come on, we have to go do something. And we ended up in a small private television studio with Ted Kennedy, recording an ad for my dad's business partner. I'm sitting there at 13 or 14 years old with Ted Kennedy's arm around my shoulder. I thought, this is pretty cool. I'm not sure I had any ethic about it at the time.
But you developed a lot of integrity along the line that you learned back then.
Well, I think in our house and with my dad and my mother as well, but with my dad, he was so involved in politics and social policy that it was all about understanding the issues from a substantive perspective, but also maintaining intellectual integrity. And I saw him on several occasions take a personal beating because he stood by he's just stuck by it, and mm-hmm. he showed his integrity. And that always stuck with me, that was more important to him than winning.
How has that particular principle actually helped you achieve success as a professional?
I think it's, on one level, I think one of the reasons PSC has been successful is that we have a reputation, and I'm told this by others, and it's not just me making it up, that we have a reputation for when we advocate and lobby. People may disagree with us, but we don't just come in and throw homilies at them and sermons. It's based on a lot of substantive thought, and then there's an intellectual engagement. I think that comes out of that sort of thread of, if you're going to do something, understand it and have some integrity about it. I think also it really affected sort of my view of people in the political world when you have disagreements. I mean, you can really dislike somebody. You can despise their position, and there are cases where it's pretty extreme. But for the most part, in political and policy discourse, the fact that somebody vehemently disagrees with you doesn't mean they're not a patriot. And that's kind of, to me, a bottom line we try to maintain. And I'm constantly talking to companies about this and our staff about, just remember, you know, the civil servants are hardworking folks. They're out there trying to do what they're doing. Political appointees have a political agenda, but by and large, they're still patriots at their heart. And you have to have that. And there's a big difference between difference of opinion and having integrity and recognizing patriotism where it is.
Do you ever have political arguments with your dad?
All the time. All the time. And they can get very heated. He's 93, so it's, you know, this is what he lives for now.
Yeah, that's right. That's his best. That's his favorite thing to
exactly.
do.
Exactly.
So you had a chance to go around a bit with him in your formative years.
Yeah.
What characteristic do you bring to your leadership style today that you can trace back to your dad?
I think it's the intellectual integrity part. It's integrity sort of across the board. I mean, he was a guy who was in politics but also ran summer camp for kids. I mean, and when he was running a campaign, I remember that he was running a partial presidential campaign. He had people come to him at the summer camp because, I'm taking care of the kids this summer. I've got 200 kids in this camp. Uh-huh. It's priorities, it's integrity, it's understanding more than just sort of the political or business outcome you're looking for. I think that we have a lack of that sometimes. Mm-hmm. I found actually in this industry, this government contracting industry, far more of it than people realize. Mm-hmm. I'm continually impressed with people I meet in executive levels and at the operational level who actually really feel strongly, passionately about what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And I think I took that from him, is have some passion, have knowledge, and go do it. Don't just do it for the money or don't do it to win.
Yeah. And how about from your mom? Anything particular in your leadership style that shows up that's a characteristic of your mom?
I think a willingness to question things. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of the biggest arguments I saw them my parents have was over politics. And I admired the fact, you know, my father's a very strong person, very strong personality. He's larger than life. He's very prominent. My mother, you know, didn't hesitate to take him on when she felt so. You know, this talk truth to power kind of attitude right. was there as well.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
I have an older brother and a younger sister.
So you're the middle child.
I'm the middle child.
And what did being the middle child do for your life and career?
I think my theory is that middle children, probably not all the time, but a lot of middle children don't emerge in a leadership role until much later than the average, because you're kind of in between. You're in the sandwich. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And my brother was very musically talented and so forth. My sister's beautiful and brilliant. And so I just sort of went about life and enjoyed it and so forth. And it wasn't until later in life that I actually started thinking maybe I had some capability as a leader, and things started coming together.
Did you have any turning points that helped you kind of wake up to that?
I had one when I was working in the Clinton administration right after I had started. The first week I was in the Pentagon, I came out of a meeting, been in the secretary's office, and I was standing in the hallway talking to the deputy secretary and an undersecretary. And it was just a friendly chit-chat about, you know, what's going on at home kind of thing, nothing serious. And they walked away, and I had my first cell phone. And I immediately called my father, and I said, something's very wrong with this picture. And I told him what had just happened. And he said, do you ever think that's what you've been working for 25 years? And I said, no. He said, well, that's what you've been working towards for 25 years. And I felt like I completely didn't belong.
Really? Yeah. How long did it take you to get to the point where you felt like you belonged?
Oh, it was a good 6 months or a year before I felt comfortable. I mean, I went from being a one-man show into this massive political bureaucracy, but I had great leadership there, great leadership mentoring in the department. I worked for a couple of people who I think are two of the best leaders I've ever seen, and I witnessed in the military services leadership and different styles and way they approached it that I thought was very enlightening.
Mm-hmm. What else do you think your dad saw in you? The whole time that you is taking a while to discover.
Oh, I have no idea. I think he always kept telling me I was smarter than I thought I was. But I don't know. I think that could be a few years of therapy to figure that one out. I don't know. But you could call him and ask him.
Fair enough.
You talked about mentors. What did your mentors teach you, and what have you learned about success? About what success really means?
I think that a couple of things. I think that two of the people I've worked for and watched very carefully had shared, they were very different personalities, but they shared two very common traits. One was an intellectual curiosity and passion. I mean, they didn't take things lightly. They were going to talk an issue or deal with a problem, whether it was in the Pentagon or in business or whatever. They really dug in and did their homework. And the second was they were very direct. They didn't mince words positively or negatively, but they did it in a way that was not threatening nor arrogant. It was engaging and embracing to people and giving people a chance to say, okay, why am I wrong? I had a rule in my office, which I started about 6 months after I got there to the Pentagon. I had a rule. I had 12 senior staff, and we had a regular senior staff meeting. And I introduced a no head nod rule, because in a political environment, the typical reaction, whether they're military or civilian, is to simply bow to power. I mean, that's the protocol. Right. I was essentially almost a four-star rank, and they'd nod their heads. And so I instituted a no head nod rule. You could agree with me, but don't nod your head. And if you disagreed, you had to tell me. And we ended up having some really robust discussions. And I saw actually that done by others. It was not an original thought on mine. Mm-hmm. So a lot of it had to do with do your homework, but also embrace people and give them a chance to do their own what they do.
What advice do you give someone who's working for somebody who does have a head nod rule?
Yeah, I think that's the hardest thing. I've done some mentoring for mid-career civil servants, mm-hmm. and others, and that comes up a lot because the system tends to breed that mentality. Yeah. And my two pieces of advice are: you have got to make your stand, and if your stand's not accepted, you need to make a move. Mm. You can't let yourself just, you know, be sublimated to that. And that's very, very hard. It's much easier to say than do. But I've counseled people to get the heck out of where they were, because they were never going to be able to spread their wings and do what they want, what they could do, and achieve their capabilities.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the significant challenges for the constituency that you cover at the Professional Services Council over this period of this recession? It's been a difficult time for your constituency.
It's been very hard, and I think it's been a real test of leadership in every company. Mm-hmm. And there's every flavor of success, failure, what have you, we've seen. So, but this is let me put it concisely. We not only have had the recession and the sequestration and so forth that's mm-hmm. affected the market as a volume,
right.
And sort of the competitive nature and so forth. There's also some very fundamental tectonic shifts taking place in the industry itself, mm-hmm. from what we call in the business the move to an as-a-service model. So the government's getting out of technology infrastructure, and they want to buy everything as a service. So mm-hmm. business models are undergoing massive changes. The old lines between the traditional professional services and technology world completely obliterated. So 5 years ago, I would never have thought that I would count Amazon, AT&T, and companies like that as members of PSC, mm-hmm. and they are, as well as CACI and all the others who've been there for a long time. Mm-hmm. And that is a big leadership challenge, because there's going to be a lot of very significant shifts.
If your dad was sitting here, what would you like to tell him you've never told him before?
You know, I can honestly tell you, I think I probably told him everything. I introduced him when he was speaking one night, and I gave this very flowery introduction, and his line was, save it for the graveside. So I tell him all the time that his passion for doing good is what's driving not only me, but my brother, my sister, my kids. It's bled all the way through the family.
Mm-hmm. What's the website?
www.pscouncil.org.
This is Dana Theus with my co-host Colin Callahan. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in just a moment.
And your name is?
David Shulman.
And David, the organization is?
Information Concepts.
And what makes Information Concepts special?
We're a fixed-price, full lifecycle custom software development
shop. Wait. Your fixed-price software development. How long have you guys been around?
32 years.
So how do you manage to do that? You must have some very special processes to make sure that you sell what you can deliver with confidence and then deliver what you sell. Otherwise, you wouldn't be around this long. Do you have any repeat customers?
All our customers are repeat customers.
So you're telling me that customers buy software development from you because they know they get a fixed price. They know what they're going to get. Do you guarantee a timeline also?
Absolutely. Everything's guaranteed. Every screen, every process, every report, line item and priced, and every line item has a date.
Wait a minute. So you're telling me that all the interim processes are dated and priced so that when you get to the final result, there's no surprises?
Exactly.
Huh, and how long have you been doing this for?
We've been doing it 32 years. What we've done in the last few years, if I might, is develop a visualization process that allows the clients to actually see what we're going to build and take it out for a test drive and kick the tires without us writing a line of code.
What's the website address for this organization?
Infoconcepts.com.
Let me have that one more time.
Infoconcepts.com.
This has been your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Dana Theus, with my co-host, Colin Callahan. Next up, we have Sharon Virts, founder and CEO of FCI Federal. Sharon, what is FCI Federal?
Well, thank you first, Dana, for having us here today, Colin. FCI Federal, we are a government contractor, and we support agencies that basically supply or approve benefits for their constituents. And we do a lot of the back office work and the adjudication support work for those customers.
And how big is it today?
Oh, well, we just won a very large contract. So on or about June 23rd, we'll be about 3,000 employees in 43 states and territories in the U.S. In over 100 offices nationwide.
And you founded this big company now.
I did.
Why did you do this thing?
Well, I didn't really start off with that in mind. I actually started the business about 23 years ago. So if you do the math, you can figure out I'm a little older than I should be. But I was 29 years old. I'd been working for a number of systems integrators and decided that I was going to start my own business. And that business back then was to provide market research, business development, consulting services to the large systems integrators. And after a number of years, we did well for a while. And then we didn't do so well for a while, and I changed the business model and specifically chose this particular industry.
So, yeah, and you described it earlier as having a sort of an aha where you said, oh, my gosh, my baby's ugly, the business
isn't
working.
Yeah, that would be my quote, yeah. yeah, actually, you know, I was 29 and was not afraid to sort of step out on my own and start the company. And we did really, really well for a really long time. And I took my eye off the ball. I didn't pay attention to competitors. And I didn't pay attention to my customers and what was happening in the market. Mergers and acquisitions shrunk our customer base by about 50% in a matter of no time.
So when you woke up to the fact that you'd taken your eye off the ball, how did you feel?
Defeated. We really had to make some really tough, tough changes. The first one was in 2002. We closed the offices in Tysons Corner, Virginia, and moved to Reston and kind of restructured the corporation a little bit and downsized and tried to make a go of it with a leaner staff. And it worked for a little while, but by 2004, I did. I woke up one morning and I realized that my baby was ugly and I had to make a huge change. And it was probably one of the hardest things I've ever had to do.
And this really makes me see you very much as a survivor. And I'm wondering, going back all the way to when you were young, when did that survivor instinct really crop up?
You know, it is an interesting question because I don't think that you look back and go, there's an aha moment. It's sort of a, life's a journey, right?
Mm-hmm.
But for me, you know, I grew up here locally in the Virginia area, and we were really poor, like really, really
like
poor.
How poor?
Like, we lived in a very small, teeny tiny house where one of the rooms had a dirt floor, where that, you know, we lived off what we grew, what my father hunted, and what we found on the road. You know, there's all those roadkill stories about people from West Virginia. Well, how about one from Virginia? And I never knew I was poor. I mean, my parents were wonderful people and had a wonderful little childhood. Mm-hmm. And then I went to elementary school. And I had all the other kids tell me that I was poor. Mm-hmm. And parents wouldn't allow their kids to come play at our house because mm-hmm. we were poor. And they were mean, really mean. And I became pretty tough. So, as a result of that.
Yeah, I was going to say, how did that make you feel and what was the response?
Well, you know, when you're little, you cry a lot and you get upset. But I tend to not do a whole lot of that. And I got tough. I realized that I needed to make a difference for myself. I needed to focus on education, focus on doing well in school, and focus on leadership. Mm-hmm. And in about the fifth grade, my best friend had moved away. My brother was starting elementary school, and I didn't want him to go through the same sort of struggles that I'd gone through, and I became really tough. And so tough that, you know, when the new school was built out in Lucketts, Virginia, I was the one that received the key to the school from the school board.
And how old were you?
Oh, 9? Maybe 10? You know, that leadership, I think, is really set me apart from a lot of the competitors in our market today, mm-hmm. And of course, sort of set me apart from a lot of the kids I went to school with. Mm-hmm. So,
what your parents were loving and supportive?
They were. My parents are simple people. My father worked as a mechanic, mm-hmm. has an eighth grade education. My mother was a mill worker, mm-hmm. in a local factory out in Leesburg at the time. So, but they were very supportive. You know, it's interesting too. My dad says, "You're going to go to college." I'm about 6 or 7, uh-huh. and if you're going to college, you're going to be either a teacher or a nurse. And I said, "What about if I was a doctor?" You know, of course, I realized about 13 I couldn't take the sight of blood, so that wasn't going to work out so well for me. But you know, he always pushed us to do better and to go far.
So, as a business owner and leader, what are some of the characteristics that you got from your mom that show up in your day-to-day?
Not so much from my mother. Mm-hmm. Most of my leader characteristics come from my grandmother, uh-huh. on my dad's side, and from my father. Uh-huh. My mom is, she's a hardworking individual, and she doesn't quit, so I think the perseverance came from her. Yeah. But my dad is one that is always looking for a new idea, and he likes to know everything about something. He's very passionate, mm-hmm. and I think passionate, perseverance, and being persistent.
Yeah, sounds like curiosity too.
Yeah, lots of curiosity, uh-huh. from those folks. Yeah.
And you said you have brothers and sisters.
I have just one little brother. Mm-hmm. One.
And you were the big sister.
I was the big sister.
And that was being the big sister part of how you learned to be tough?
I think being the older one. Mm-hmm. It wasn't whether I was a girl or a boy. Actually, most of the girls I went to school with probably thought I was a boy in terms of, you know, I played pretty tough. But, no, my little brother, you know, I had a responsibility to sort of take care of him and look out for him a lot. Mm-hmm. And he was 3 years younger. Of course, today he'll tell you that he's, you know, 5 years younger. And each birthday he has, he's like 6 years younger. You know, he doesn't want to get near that 50-year-old mark anytime soon.
So there's sometimes on our leadership journey, we realize being tough actually is not the appropriate response.
Correct.
How have you learned that lesson? How have you learned to become a more broad brushed leader?
Well, I think that if you ask the folks that work for me, they will tell you that I'm compassionate. And I have a lot of compassion for our employees. And, you know, I see a lot of the struggles that our employees go through. I mean, we are not, you know, high-end kind of consulting where people are making six-figure incomes. I mean, most of our employees are covered under the Service Contract Act, so they're wage employees. And it's tough. It's a tough world out there. So we do our darndest to give them great benefits and to treat them as family members with compassion. And I think what separates our company from most is the human capital, the human side of things, to me, is much more important than the process and then and the technology, and it's how you treat your people. Mm-hmm. And seeing my mother work in a factory and how she was treated makes a huge difference in terms of the way I look at our workforce.
So it must have been especially hard for you when you had to restructure and
I had to lay people off.
Yeah.
How? It was really tough.
What did you learn in those situations?
I need to make better decisions. I understand truly the importance of being fiscally responsible and making sure you're market conscious. And I think the most important thing is that change is the only constant. And when you hang on to a dying dream, you're not the only person that's hurt by that.
Mm-hmm.
You told us in the green room, if I got it correctly, that in 2007, you were about 35 people.
We were 35 people, $1.8 million in revenue in 2007, yes.
And now you're about to be 3,000.
3,000.
And there's been a few things going on in the economy from 2007 right, to a little today, bit. Especially in the government contracting market. So what are some of the things that you focused on and overcame to be successful?
Number one is we chose agencies mm-hmm. and programs that were funded by fees, by user fees, and not funded by the discretionary budget. So we are not subject to what Congress may or may not pass. Mm-hmm. Now, we have a fiscal responsibility to keep our rates low,
yeah,
so that the users that use the services of immigration or the Coast Guard or whomever pay lower fees. We don't want their rates to go up. Mm-hmm. But as long as the people want to come here to this country, we're in good shape. So that's one thing we did. Mm-hmm. Second thing we did is I chose an industry that was largely staff augmentation focused, mm-hmm. and we have made it much more of a fixed unit price, fixed price, performance based, outcome based business. Mm-hmm. And as a result, we are able to put in good processes and good practices and motivate employees to do more. And as a result, it improves our margin and keeps us healthy and keeps us competitive.
Mm-hmm. You have a family too.
I do indeed.
You have many children.
Well, many. I have four
more
boys.
Than me.
I have four boys, and I can't believe I'm going to say this on the radio, a grandson. And I am not old enough to have one of those.
You don't look old enough to have a grandson.
Yeah, I have four boys. My oldest son is 28. He's a musician in Austin, Texas. My son, other son is 25 with my grandson, and he works for us at the company as a program analyst and is going to hopefully carry the legacy of the business on. I have one boy who's 14, that would be Zach, going on 40, and then my youngest son, Nikki.
So where do you find the greatest challenge in life, being a mother or running a government contracting business?
You know, that's another good question. I think that's the balance. That's the issue. It's the work-life balance.
Mm-hmm.
Really tough, particularly when you're a female CEO and you have the responsibilities, at least socially, for both.
Yep. What's the website?
www.fci, as in Frank Federal, fcifederal.com.
This is your host, Dana Theis. I'd like to thank my co-host, Colin Callahan of Colin Callahan and Associates, for helping me with the interviews. I'd like to thank our sponsors today, Dixon Hughes Goodman in Tyson's Corner, Virginia. I'd like to thank all our guests, and Bassage, CEO of the Neurology Center, Jack London, Executive Chairman and Chairman of the Board, CACI International, and author of the book, Character, the Ultimate Success Factor, Stan Sulloway, President and CEO of the Professional Services Council, and Sharon Virts, Founder and CEO of FCI Federal. And finally, I'd like to thank you, our listening audience, for listening, because otherwise we wouldn't have a radio show. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of of Federal Community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. This page